Almost Music. Fast schon Musik. I must tell you something.
Okay.
This morning I found the first recording of a Mozart symphony, which I really enjoyed listening.
Ah, recording of his first symphony?
No, first, I think
what do you mean first recording?
Jupiter symphony, or I don't know which one.
Jupiter, okay.
49, 50, 51, something. It was a sample of three ones in this album, and I just listened to them once. But normally I really hate Mozart symphonies because they are boring in my mind.
Ooh.
And that was the first time that I listened to a recording of a Mozart symphony, and I really enjoyed to listen to it.
Which recording was it?
It was from Ensemble Resonanz from Hamburg.
Ah, I see. And, I don't know them.
I don't know why. I was sitting in the train and Googling a little bit, or have a look on Spotify to this ensemble, because I heard them in concert, I think, last week. And there's one track of them from the Jupiter Symphony. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't care. Mm-hmm. I can put the link into the show notes.
Yes.
But, and this recording has 50 million clicks. I was, oh fucking hell. Normally, if you see such a recording on Spotify, it's not a good thing, because, you know, this recording is in a very popular playlist, and that's the reason why it has so many clicks.
Yeah.
So, in the most case, not in every case, but in a lot of cases, these are not very good recordings of this one. But I thought, okay, you've got the time, listen a little bit to it. And if it's bad, you can switch off after 30 seconds and nothing happened. It doesn't take any time.
Right.
But it was a very, very good one. It was very lively. And I think it was a very nice interpretation.
Wow. So are you willing to retract what you said about not liking Mozart symphonies?
they are boring.
Wait, how many symphonies were in this album?
Three ones.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this whole question of how do we actually judge whether we like the works themselves?
Yeah,
or we like the to which extent can we separate these two?
Yeah,
it's sort of the question that I've been having in my head,
yeah,
for a while recently.
And I think it really, you can't unrelate them completely. You can't say if it's a good composition without a good interpretation, because mm-hmm. it's the same. The result is that you hear stuff. So, and I mean, yes, a good composition is a little bit like the basic for this, but it's not the only base. It's, you also need good musicians and a good feeling for the thing. For me and Mozart, it's a little bit, I think I didn't heard a lot of good Mozart interpretations before, but I neither like Haydn or the whole Wiener classic is not my favorite music, because it's in a lot of cases this is very sweet music, and it's a little bit like eating a handful of sweets or something like that, or pure sugar. And
oh, interesting! I never thought of it that way. Yeah, anyway,
and
yeah,
in many cases it. Or I'd listen very simple, and a little bit too simple for my taste, I think. But this interpretation had a lot of nuances. I didn't heard in a Mozart symphony so many nuances before.
Interesting. Do you think you can say the same about chamber music by Mozart and Haydn? Or instrumental, like solo instrumental works, do you find them just equally as boring as the symphonies?
Yeah,
I see.
I must say yes. I mean, for I didn't listen to every Mozart symphony, because how many did he compose?
41, as far as I know.
Okay, that's a lot.
Yeah. Well, Haydn composed many more.
Yeah, 150 or something like this.
Oh, not quite 100. 104-ish. Anyway, over 100. That is a lot. Yeah.
And I mean, there are composers which just composed 9 completely. Beethoven.
Ooh, yes. I guess, yeah, there's a reduction in number of symphonies composed by. I mean, you know, if we consider how many cantatas, for example, Bach wrote, or
yeah,
you know, even outside of cantatas, you know, how much music Bach wrote in general. 104 symphonies sounds like a lot, but it maybe isn't. Anyway, it's just, it's astonishing how many notes these composers were able to put down on paper. It's mind-boggling. But anyway, I think I understand why you would say that these works, or, well, let's just say generally music by Haydn and Mozart. Because those were the composers that you mentioned, that you find them a little bit boring. For someone who love works by Mozart and Haydn, I think just in general, actually, you know, I don't think I can specifically say I like these types of works by Haydn or something. I think I do like Haydn in general, with exception of a few things. But anyway, that's a topic for another day. My suspicion has always been that they just aren't performed very well.
That's possible. That's definitely possible. I mean, I had to play, I think, 2 Mozart sonatas for my studies.
Yeah.
One for the application to the university and one for another exam. I don't know. But I mean, I wasn't able to play this works very well, but I'm very interested into your opinion. For me, it was a little bit like this very simple music, but if you don't play it well, it doesn't open its whole universe, or it doesn't open anything.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as a performer, the most important approach that you can take for these works when you perform them is to think of the rhetorical aspect. Like, you have to make this music sound like it's speaking or singing. And I don't know. I mean, I think even if you do succeed in making these works sound more speaking, the question is sort of the context of the world we live in today. Okay, well, you know, or where I live, let's say. even would the best performance of this music speak to us? That is another issue. Maybe it won't. But I think not considering the context in which it's being performed, if it's performed well, and, you know, every note is infused with some kind of nuance, as you said, brilliantly, or meaning, quote unquote, or certain attitude or color, and it unfolds in a particular flow of time, let's say, then I think it can be really, really, really exciting. And the trouble with ensemble music is that it's difficult to achieve these things when it's more than one person playing.
Yeah, and I mean, in the case of the symphonies, I think around 30 persons.
Yeah, and then you would need a leader. And then that leader would have to generate the right sense of flow of music, which is a skill in itself. And I think what makes Mozart particularly difficult is that you do actually really need really good players. Good as in, like, you know, people who have a real grasp of their instruments, technically, and that they don't have any limitations in terms of, you know, or technical limitations, let's just say. That's one thing. And then everybody needs to tap into sort of the same flow of time or a line, let's say, musical line. And this is difficult. The problem with conducting gestures, if there's a conductor, is that we would roughly have to use a pattern, you know. If it's like of if it's music in 4/4, do we conduct it in 2 or do we conduct it in 4 is sort of the, you know, favorite question that we all ask as conductor. But this is, unfortunately, the answer is more complicated. Because you do have to choose one of these patterns most of the time. Or it could be one, let's say. It could be pattern of 1, pattern of 2, pattern of 4. And the music flows neither in 1, nor in 2, nor in 4. And this is the problem that we're dealing with. And very often it sounds like it's beaten in one of these patterns. And it should really sound like it's not beaten in anything.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that technical issue that makes ensemble playing difficult for something like Mozart.
Mm. Yeah, what I also think is that ensemble resonance, especially is a ensemble with very independent players. So yes, of course, they're playing an ensemble and they create one sound, but every musician brings his own experience and idea into the music, also of Mozart into the music. And I think it is a recording with conductor, don't ask me who. But when I listened to it correctly, I could imagine that this person's job, the conductor's job, was just to bring all these experiences and all these ideas together into one direction, huh. And not to say the musicians how they should play, because every one of them studied, so they should have their own ideas.
Yeah.
What's your experience with it?
You're saying it's a democratic process? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. A little bit, yes.
You have to find a compromise amongst all these conflicting ideas or something. No, I mean, I guess we're in luck if the ideas are sort of, you know, in the similar vein. If it's not, I think, this is a good question. I don't know. I think I rarely got the sense, I mean, when I stood in front of a group to conduct or something, I rarely got the sense that I'm dealing with a lot of people who have very divergent ideas about a piece of music. Very often it's like I go to a place and I stand in front of a group and sort of my ideas about the music diverges from the group's idea of the music. That's more or less the case. And then your job as a conductor is to figure out what we can both do together. But I feel like in most cases, a group is more or less unified. And if it's not unified, it's most likely a technical issue. Mm-hmm. It's not an issue about divergent musical ideas per se. Because I think what happens, you know, the bigger the group gets, the more infectious certain ideas become. And then people kind of tap into a certain atmosphere without knowing. I think this is something that I suspect happens in a large group. When an ensemble is smaller, and therefore each individual player takes on a bit or more of an important role, or they're more exposed, then it's a different issue. But most often when I have to conduct something, it's a group that's larger. And that sort of, you know, a group dynamic emerges without the group actually really knowing exactly what's going on behind it at all. It's really fascinating, but it's normally me against the group.
Yeah.
And then it could be very, very interesting if my ideas are different. Then what we all achieve in the end is something neither me nor the group expected. And that could be very, very interesting. So I think as a conductor, you have to go in with the mindset that, yes, I have these ideas. You know, if you do your job well, then you have more than one concept, or, you know, many, many different configurations, and then not configurations, but like, you know, you can unfold a piece of music in 1,000 different ways. Mm. And then you have to feel for what is offered to you, and then you offer something, and then you see what, you know, what the response is. So in that way, you just have to be, it's thrilling if you don't go in with something really concrete and specific that you want out of it. But if it's, you know, if you're uncomfortable doing that, then it could be very uncomfortable, let's say. Anyway, so how does all of this relate to Mozart's symphonies or Haydn symphonies? I'm sorry to say, but Haydn symphonies are performed very, I mean, in a way that isn't very exciting.
I can or from say my experiences. Anything to this because I once listened to them and I decided that's not my music. I can't find anything interesting for me in this music, actually.
Yeah.
But sometimes I try some music where I said in the past, oh, that's not my music.
Mm.
I mean, we have Spotify today. It doesn't take a lot to find a recording of anything.
Yeah.
And listen to it. But finding interesting music on Spotify, and especially these ones which I don't know, or yeah, it's really hard, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
It's easier to find something which you already know.
That's true, yeah. I think with things like Haydn symphonies, the difficulty is that there are, like, you know, complete editions or, like, complete Haydn symphony, like, albums.
Yeah.
Which is great for people who want to get to know the works. But very often, you know, I find some performances of some symphonies good and then others not. Yeah. It's very much a mixture. Whereas, you know, if I find an album with a Haydn symphony in it that I find really good, it's just like, you know, a certain set of pieces and then it's not complete. And then it's so like trying to find a really good recording of each symphony is very, very, very difficult. Maybe I should, you know, take this on as a project. Really comb through Spotify and or YouTube. Yeah, to try to find recordings of each symphony that I really like. I don't know. That could take years.
Yeah, if they are already recorded.
Yeah, no, I think there are complete editions.
Yeah, of course.
Not editions, but yeah, like complete work, Haydn symphonies or something.
Compilation, whatever.
Yeah. But other than that, I think it is really difficult to perform Haydn symphonies. From my experiences, like, they require a lot of editing in the sense that you have to mark a lot of information that isn't there. Or, like, you know, we shouldn't forget that these composers, you know, for them, it's kind of like it was their day job to, like, write music. And they had to, like, finish certain pieces, or they had, like, clear deadlines that they had to meet and stuff. So they were very much in a hurry to get all this down on paper. And then, you know, my assumption is that for Haydn, for example, because he was the one who was also involved in getting these things performed, he didn't have to specify a lot of the nuances or anything that need to be clarified for the performers. And he didn't need to get these things down onto paper.
Yeah, because he was able to rehearse with the musicians and tell them directly.
Yeah, exactly.
And the aesthetics of the music in this time was a completely different than today.
Absolutely. So then, you know, we have to put it in context of sort of our times, or, like, you know, the performance practice that is prevalent in our times, which is that a lot of things are written down for the performers to look at. And this is the work that need to be done before any of these Haydn symphonies. I mean, not any of them. I mean, some of them have really good editions, some of them not. And then you kind of work with an empty palette with notes, let's say. And then you have to figure out, you know, the bowings need to be figured out, articulation needs to be figured out, you know, sort of possible dynamic narrative. All these things need to be figured out. And something I find is that, you know, this sort of the Ertex virus that a lot of people are suffering from nowadays, that Ertex means like, you know, oh, these are God's words and we have to take them seriously. Yeah.
Just Urtext means that somebody who make an edition of the scrolls doesn't add anything which is not in the manuscript.
Yeah, exactly.
Or in the first print or whatever he or she's editing.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, it's a very good thing because you don't have any information which are not from the composer. But on the other hand, you must know a lot more things about the music. Because, for example, I mean, we have the same problem in Baroque music, because there are, in normal cases, there are no information about, for example, articulation or legato or vibrato or something like this. And it's possible to deal with them, with this in this music, but there are no information about this in the scores. So it's necessary to make a lot of, also to study a lot of sources, like I think from nearly every time there are a lot of manuals, for example, for students or for other musicians, which are also written in very different contexts, and you have to read them and to interpretate what this writer wants to say about the music in this time. And I think that's nearly the same, or it is the same work you have to do with Haydn and Mozart or not.
Absolutely. I think there needs to be a lot of work done in creating sort of new performance editions of these works. Mm. Urtext is great, as you said. And there are sort of performance editions from, you know, the late 19th century that haven't necessarily incorporated the research that is now more available to us, or, you know, take performance practice of the times more under consideration. And I think this work needs to be done. And I think this is one of the problems that we're facing when it comes to Mozart or Haydn symphonies. Well, Mozart maybe a little bit less so. I don't know. But I think actually it is very similar. If you look at Bärenreiter, Mozart's scores, it looks very empty. Very much. I mean, it's you know, very often it's like, even for piano sonatas, you see like piano, and then 50 measures later, forte. You know, like, it's like, does it mean that nothing else happens between those two?
Of course not.
Is the answer.
Yeah.
Because every note has to be infused with some kind of dynamic color. And actually...
Yeah, and with intention. I mean, yes, on the one hand, you can say, okay, that are God's words. We don't add anything in the interpretation. But on the other hand, do you really think that Mozart play such boring stuff?
Of course not.
It was not classical music, like... Nowadays, it is a little bit, has this old blah.
Yeah.
But in this time, it was the pop music of this time. So there was no tradition or something like this. It was the music. So do you really think it was stupid like this if you're playing Urtext like, that's God words, I don't add anything? No, of course not.
Of course not.
Please stop it and don't record anything of this, because there are not enough recordings. We don't need any more bad recordings, please. Yeah.
We don't need any more recordings with, you know, piano for 50 measures and a forte. We don't need any of those. And I think it doesn't really matter which period we're looking at. Is it possible to put every single intention of a composer down onto paper? Of course not. And also, are these sort of ideas always set in stone in composers' heads? Probably not. You know, I don't know. Maybe I am a human being who functions you know, or maybe I'm, my thoughts are more fluid than others, or I don't know. Or, you know, some people's ideas are less, okay, maybe we should cut this part. This is a little bit controversial. But I think, you know, all of our ideas are fluid to a certain extent. You know, it may be that I wake up tomorrow and then I see things differently. Yeah. This is totally possible. And I should allow myself to feel differently about things. This is what makes life interesting for me. In which case, you know, are things that are written down already something that we really should view as something that is absolutely set in stone and we shouldn't be allowed to change any of this? Yes and no. I don't know. I mean, this is something that I have to ask myself each time I look at a score by somebody. Mm. And then, it, you know, we have to also bring in sort of the existing research that we have in judging or playing the detective work in saying, yes, Brahms was more deliberate about giving performance instructions about what to do. Let's say, compared to Haydn. How much license do we allow in... Or, yeah, how much license do we have in case of this work by this composer? Do you see what I mean? Or, like, how much freedom do we have to see things this way or that?
Yeah.
Or how literally do we take certain markings? And these, yeah, again, it's detective work.
Yeah.
And the clues are, you know, what we have to work with.
Yeah. I must say, I see it very liberate because, I mean, Brahms is dead. He can't say anything against.
It's true. We can't call him and ask.
So on one hand, we can't call him and ask. And on the other hand, he will not say anything against it. So I think it's very... very important to have not a logical, but yes, an like logical interpretation. It must make sense, but there are many different ways to create this, and and that also doesn't mean that I prefer recordings where you hear that the persons are not good informed, that they don't make any thoughts about. Yes, sometimes you have a good interpretation without making a lot of thoughts, but it's a little bit like, that's random.
Hmm.
So you, I prefer, it's a little bit like Loriot, I prefer recordings which are not randomly good.
Although randomly good is better than bad.
Yeah, but... You know the sketch of Loriot where a man has his egg for a cooked egg for breakfast, and he asks his wife about how long was this egg cooking?
Oh yes,
she said
yes. Yes.
I don't Those mind that my that my egg is randomly hard enough.
This is a great
The wife said before, ich krieg's nicht übersetzt, im Gefühl. Eine Hausfrau hat das im Gefühl.
Ah, ja. what is a Hausfrau in English?
Boah.
Oh, my God. Housewife?
That,
that is a word.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. That is a word. A housewife.
A housewife has a feeling for this.
Has a feel for...
Yeah.
For it, yeah, it's a brilliant sketch. Anyway, we can link it in the show notes. Yeah, interpretation. Yes, that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, yeah, and there since the beginning of the 20th century, a little bit before, a little bit after. There's one more source we have available. We have recordings from this time, and it was very interesting for me when I first looked to the episode of earlymusicsources.com. They have a episode where Elam Rotem compares different recordings from the beginning of the 20th century with interpretations from nowadays.
Wow.
And they are so completely different.
Interesting.
So completely different. For example, I think there was one recording of Tchaikovsky, Schwansee, Swan, whatever.
Swan Lake.
Yeah, Swan Lake.
Yeah. It's okay.
Swansea, yes.
Oh, Swansea. Oh, Swansea. I like the sound of it better. Swansea, yeah.
Swan Lake. And I think it's a oboe, a solo oboe at the beginning. And I really can recommend this video. It's very interesting what he said about the music and about the different in the sound aesthetics.
Interesting. How different?
I hope I can explain it well in English. I think if you are really interested, look this video. But anyway,
yes, I will.
But for example, this the solo oboe and the recordings of the early 20th century is more. Has much more freedom. Mm-hmm. It's in most cases it's a little bit late. It's not on the same beat. The oboe is a little bit later and plays this this upgoing line. It's not like in modern interpretations the notes have in most cases really the same length.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in this interpretation it is they are much shorter. It's more ba-da-da-da-da, something like this.
Oh, I see.
Much more freely.
Yeah, which makes me think I think both can be good actually. No,
both can be
good. I was gonna say, I mean, I tend to say no note length should be played exactly the same anyway. The note length that we understood objectively or in the abstract sense is of course the same. Those da 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 da, those at least the first four notes have the same length. They should never be played exactly the same length, obviously, because that is not the way we would sing it or speak it.
Yeah, but in the most in a lot of interpretation you can hear on Spotify, YouTube, whatever, it's
more or less it. Yeah, they feel the same. Yeah, but that's again. I think that's sort of the sostenuto aesthetics. Sorry, I just completely made that up. That is not a thing. And I think, you know, they can equally be good. But it's interesting that, you know, why is sort of that... why is one way of playing tied to a certain period of time? That's what interests me. You know, why isn't it that we now played either this or that? Or like, you know, sometimes we played more freely and sometimes we don't. Rather than, well, back in the days, it used to be that people used to play these notes or equal notes more unequally in length. I don't know. It's fascinating. It's something that I haven't thought about. Or does it pertain to a particular interpretation? I don't know. I need to look at the video first before saying anything about it.
Maybe we can talk in the next episode about it. And
again. Yes. So many interesting things to look at, actually. I did want to ask you... what you think about Händel, because I recently, it's one of the things that I recently listened to. I don't know, but I don't know why. But I had a craving for Handel's Concerto Grosso Opus 6. Yeah, very random. It's Handel's Concerto Grosso Opus 6. That's a set of six works.
Mm.
And I encountered these works in Manchester when I was studying with the brilliant Roger Hamilton. He was like leading some students at the keyboard, and like, you know, we were talking about, he performed these in rehearsal or whatever. And I really, he made me get more excited about Handel.
Mm.
Because when I mention Handel, people's reactions are generally kind of like, oh, how sophisticated. Not in a very nice way. Or, you know, like, Handel.
Yeah.
Oh, you know. So I was wondering what you think of Handel.
Hmm. I must say that I didn't took a lot of time for Handel. I'd once play one of his organ concerts with a little ensemble in Thüringen.
Uh-huh.
In concert. And I think Hidden is a little bit like maybe a little bit like Mozart in some cases. When I learned about Handel first, it was a little bit like, he's also a Baroque composer. He lives in the same time like Bach, but the most important composer is Bach, obviously. So a little bit like, Handel is a little bit like the little brother, or like the, he's also existing, but the more exciting works are from Bach, something like this. I think that's not fair, because Bach is, there's Baroque music and there's Bach in some case.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely other style of music. And I think for me, Handel's music is very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
It's has a very, very, friendly mood. A lot of pieces are, just friendly. They are not very graving or very sad or very
I see. I know what you mean.
Hard to explain.
Is it kind of along the same line as you saying
it's not
Haydn's music? It's kind of like taking in sweets. Is it similar or not?
No, I don't think so, because for me Haydn is like just eating pure sugar. And Handel is a little bit more, there's a fruit around the sugar.
That's very clever. I think for some people, it's like, you know, I love sugar, unfortunately. So it doesn't sound so bad. But for some others who don't like sugar all that much, it really doesn't sound like a compliment to Haydn, I mean. So that was very cleverly put.
Yeah, but what I want to say is, it's, for example, Bach is sometimes has very heavy moods in the music, and Handel don't has this one. They are also heavy pieces, but it's not the main thing of his music, I think.
Hmm.
And and it is really also, it is virtuosic music in a lot of cases. The
True.
The keyboard works are fucking hard to play.
Yes.
And the organ concertos, for example, they are not hard to play. It's easy to learn, but hard to einfach zu lernen, schwierig zu meistern.
Easy to learn, hard to master.
Yeah,
something like that. Yeah.
Because they're so simple, and you must pay a lot of attention to create this music in a very nice. And bring some, you need a lot of intention for the music. Mm. You must know what you want to say with it.
Mm.
I think it's basically the same for all music, but especially for Handel, because he gives a lot of freedom in his pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, but also it makes a lot of fun to make his music. I sang in my exams for singing, my singing exams for studies, one or two Handel arias, and
wow.
That was very hard for me, but they fit very good to my voice at this moment, because I have for some of these arias, I have a very good range, and they go very, very deep.
Hmm.
So something like A or something like this, and then you have to go upwards with the voice. And that was something at this time which I could do very good.
Ah, interesting.
Which I can go, yeah, anyway.
Is it one of those arias where you have a slow part at the beginning and then like a fast part?
It was from Messias, but Batu May Abide.
It's not that easy. It's not at all easy to sing.
And one other one I don't know.
For me.
Also for Messiah. Yeah, but this make a lot of fun.
Wow.
And I was really lucky. They had Lisa as my co-repetitor. She was one of my colleagues at in the church music studies, and she studied choral repetition before, so she was very good and
could really play. Yeah.
Yes, and she really supported me with the song.
Very nice. All the difference. Yeah.
It makes a lot of difference because I wanted to say your supporter, but yes, in this case, if the piano player or whatever your accompanist don't support you in the sound, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
You just can fail. It's you will fail, definitely.
Hi. I think Handel is also, well, it could be a rite of passage for singers. I think a lot of singers go through a lot of arias by Handel. Mm. Again, I think you need to, first of all, be able to sustain line in slower music, but also, you know, when the arias are fast or whatever, then there are a lot of virtuosic elements that you have to be able to master and things like that. Anyway, yeah. I don't know. I asked you this just because I feel like Handel is also like one of those composers who haven't been done justice in terms of performance. Like, I feel like, yeah, a lot of the recordings that I've listened to and I find actually pretty good are not as, I mean, I always feel like, but it could be more exciting or it could be more joyous.
Yes, definitely. Right. Definitely.
Or it could be more beautiful or it could be more playful. Like, it just, everything could be more.
Yeah.
And I just find it to be such a shame that it isn't. And I remember, you know, the way Roger Hamilton sort of infused this music with so much energy, I just will never forget.
Mm.
And I just think, why isn't there a recording by him, for example? You know, like,
yeah, I really understand this feeling. I think it was last year I listened to a concert of Ensemble Scirocco and chamber choir in Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot the name. Anyway, and they performed it in Haverstehude in a church. It was Dixit Dominus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one of my main problems with Ensemble Scirocco. I listen to their concerts and be upset because there are no recordings of this concert.
They are just so amazing, aren't they?
And that was one thing I really want to talk about, because they play a concert in the Leishalle on the May 19th.
Yes.
And
in Hamburg.
In Hamburg, yes. In Großer Saal, big hall. So there's a lot of space for more people to come. And it's an ensemble I really love.
I also really love this ensemble so much. They're just so stunning. One of their recordings, It's Scirocco's Seereisen. Roughly translated, it's Scirocco's Sea
Travels.
We will put it into show notes.
Yeah.
With the proper translation. It's a recording that I just keep coming back to, because every time I listen to it, I'm just like, it's just stunningly good that you can't take your ears off of this music. I mean, incredibly good. And I also listened to them live. I think it was last year or 2 years before, something like that. And they played the entire Brandenburger
concertos. Yeah, that was last year in June, I think.
Yeah. And I have to say, there isn't, I mean, in terms of like capabilities and also like the strength of music making, they're not any less good live. Actually, if anything, it's more exciting live.
Yeah.
They're just so amazing.
They're so
unbelievable.
Yeah.
And yeah, on May 19th, they'll be playing Vivaldi's Four Seasons, which is something that I really could afford to hear a very good version of. So I'm really excited about that. Yeah, Scirocco, they just, they know how to elevate each piece that they play.
It's yeah, and they are
really amazing.
Really stunning. I also heard the rehearsals for the Brandenburg Concertos. I was there at every concert because I supported them with CD,
yeah.
Not playing CD, selling CDs.
Yes.
Playing CDs, yes.
You supported them by playing their CDs, yeah.
Bah!
Yay!
It was so funny because I was there to make some social media work for them and take some pictures. And in the first rehearsal, I was just sitting there like a little child. Oh my God, they're playing so good. And then they have a very special way to rehearse because they play something, then they make a break. Everyone is chatting with each other about the about the things which happened in the last minutes or how many bars, whatever they played. And then they put this all together. And then the cellist asked me, hey, Almut, what's your opinion? How does it does it sound in the room? And I was, oh, my God, I don't. Okay, they pay attention to my opinion. I feel like a mogul under wizards. So, what can I do? It was exactly like this for me. I wasn't able to say anything.
You were stunned.
It was a little. I was so fascinated by the music and by how they rehearse, and it was really. I felt like a muggle or like a muggle under wizards and witches.
Yeah,
and I think one of the really interesting thing is they in the most cases they play without conductor. Also, if they are with 18 people or more, and they pay a lot of attention to the other ones. They have a very lively communication in the ensemble, and they really, it's not like take care, but yeah, everyone is the specialist for their instruments. So, yeah. And they take the responsibility and create something together. And yeah, it's fantastic. Really, really fantastic results.
Yeah.
So to hear them into concert is one of the best things you can do in your life.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, that speaks a lot about sort of the working process within an ensemble, that everybody has room to say something.
Yeah.
Or express their opinions. And that makes such a huge difference. But it also makes a difference that all of them are genuinely really good at their instruments.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, jaw-dropping how fantastic Rachel Harris plays.
Yeah.
For Brandenburg Concerto No. 4, which requires a lot of virtuosity from solo violinists. I mean, I was just like, I was so speechless. She was so freaking amazing. Yes, so it's definitely worth going to Hamburg to listen to their concert on May 19th. Yes, we will be there, so.
Definitely.
Yes, we hope to see you all there too.
I will sell those in CDs again. Yeah.
She will be playing CDs again. No, I'm kidding.
No, it's not necessary because they will play a wonderful concert, so I don't have to play any other CDs.
That's true. They will be playing their own CD.
Yeah.
Concert stage. Which is freaking unbelievable. Yeah. If anybody can do that. Yeah. Anyway, I think we did really well today with the time.
Yeah. Because I think we have 1 minute and 20 seconds.
Yeah, the timer is about to go off. We have this thing, by the way, for those listening.
We must say it's the 6th recording we make for this podcast, and maybe it's the first one which will release.
Yes. Maybe.
Because
we hope.
We learned a lot of things in the first 6 episodes, in the first 5 episodes, which you will never hear. Be sure. You will never hear. So,
yes.
Yeah, we have 1 more minute. So, is there something you want to say?
I think I'm fine. I think we covered a lot of base. And, you know, it's maybe better to end it before the timer goes off. Yeah, so one of the things that we learned is that we absolutely have to set a timer and just finish when it goes off. Because...
We're not in the lesson for example, piano. We often sat here and were, okay, what did you prepare? That's so typical musician stuff.
Yeah, we just get complete. I mean, it's one thing to be nerdy. That's fine. You know, we can't help it. But it's another thing to feel like we're in school and feel all rigid. So hopefully, yeah. So we have this, we have a new tradition of setting the timer, which is about to go off.
So have a nice day and enjoy your whatever you're doing.